96.5 in Sarasota, and WBPV 100.1 in Bradenton. This is Della Hale with your WSLR news headlines for Tuesday, October 15th. Siesta Key and Casey Key areas now have water restored, except for Fisherman's Haven and Sanderling Road. The boil water notice for Casey Key has been lifted. Siesta Key remains under a boil water notice. Please limit water usage. The county urges Casey Key and Siesta Key residents not to do laundry or run dishwashers at this time. For the rest of the county, inland areas are not under a boil water notice. A point of distribution is where residents can pick up essential supplies like food, water, and cleaning materials. A comfort point is a place to rest, charge your phone, and access air conditioning, providing meals and support services during recovery. Comfort points can be found at Streets of Paradise from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. at 734 Central Ave, Sarasota. Bayside Community Church, Lakewood Ranch Campus from 11:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. and at 4:30 p.m. to 6:30 p.m. daily through October 18th. Bayside Community Church, Bee Ridge Campus from noon to 7 p.m. daily through October 18th. Points of distribution are open from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. daily at the Venice Community Center at 326 Nokomis Ave, Venice, at the San Pedro Catholic Church at 14380 Tamiami Trail, Northport, Englewood Sports Complex at 1300 South River Road, Englewood, Glebe Park at 1000 Glebe Lane, Sarasota, Bayside Community Church, 8200 Beeridge Road, Sarasota. Storm debris do's and don'ts. Storm debris pickup information will be announced in the coming days. As you prepare your debris for pickup, please observe the following do's and don'ts. Do keep storm debris at least 6 feet from objects that may interfere with collection equipment. And separate debris into 4 piles: construction debris, white goods, bulk items, and vegetative debris. Don't use plastic bags for storm debris. Place storm debris in piles on the sidewalk or roadways, and don't park vehicles in front of piles. For residents needing recovery resources for Hurricane Milton, can call 1-800-342-3557. This is the State Assistance Information Line, or SAIL. It is active 24/7. There are English, Spanish, and Haitian Creole speakers available to answer your questions. This has been Della Hale with your WSLR news headlines for Tuesday, October 15th.
You are listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV 100.1 FM in Bradenton.
This is show 47 of our Changing Environment and is being recorded on October 15th, 2024. The previous show was Corduroy, hosted by Sebastian.
I'm Julie Morris.
I'm John O'Miller, and we're assisted today by Alvaro Montalegre.
Our guest today is Andrew Hudson, a Mennonite pastor and an organic farmer. Andrew is passionate about small groups growing food together and developing relationships between people and their place.
The views, comments, and opinions that come from our interview shows, on air personalities, and from our call-in guests are uncensored, and those views and opinions can be widespread and extremely diverse. The opinions or views expressed by SAME do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of WSLR, our staff, or volunteers.
Andrew, we know you as a longtime supporter and participant at WSLR, and it's great to have you on the show.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
Can you explain just some basics about organic gardening to our audience? How is manure used locally?
Wow.
Well, first of all, I don't think manure is used in a local way very much. Okay. It tends to be trucked in a lot, which mm-hmm. is a sort of entry into how organic farming can be a great benefit and can also be problematic because you use a lot of fuel to truck fertilizer. Mm-hmm. But we'll get to that. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to use the way you phrased that as sort of like a hack into where we're maybe going. But so organics have kind of multiple levels to it. Of course, organic, quote unquote, the word is a certification that people can get. You can pay money, get a certifier to come look at your farm, and then you can label your food organic. And that was a huge accomplishment that was actually a social movement from the 60s through the 90s to get that encoded into our economic system, that the word organic actually means something within capitalism. That was a huge accomplishment. And so what it means in a technical sense is there are certain harmful things that aren't happening and that you as a consumer can know you're not participating in GMOs or pesticides or chemical fertilizers. Those are all very harmful. And frankly, capitalism doesn't usually care what we do with our money. So then it empowers consumers to minimize harm. I think of it as harm reduction agriculture.
So those standards, are they nationwide or state by state? How does that work?
Yeah, that was a big issue around the turn of the century. It was state by state, and you can still get state by state certification, but there's also a federal certification, and there was a huge process in the late 90s, early 2000s. And there's a really interesting thing about certification. Sometimes having a lower bar can be better for the earth. And so Bill Pisher, my boss at Jessica's Organic Farm, he was involved in setting up the certification for the state of Florida. And they chose to let grass clippings that had pesticides on it be used for certified organic labeled farms, because then the stuff wasn't going to the landfill. So it was better for the earth in the big picture if they set the bar lower, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of deep thought that goes into this, and there are very different standards. You know, is it good for the earth, or is it good for the individual who's consuming the food? Those are actually different goals, and you got to really think it through.
So does a certification based on actual testing of the soil and the plant products, or is it more based on checking off certain practices?
Yeah, it's much more practice-based.
Okay, so this is comparable to our stormwater, where if we design it a certain way, we assume it's working. So if people are complying with the rules, it's assumed that there aren't residue, biocides, or other problems.
I'm not familiar with stormwater management, so I can't speak to the
That's
comparison.
That's another show. Yeah.
I'll have to keep listening to your show, and I'll learn more about that.
So could you explain what regenerative agriculture is?
Yeah, it's a different concept, and I'll just say one more thing about organic before I do that, just to compare them. Organic isn't just an economic certification term. It's also a social movement. And some people say it's the largest social movement in the world. It's why we got the thing into the economics. But organic farming is a thing that attracts tons of people. And so our farm has over 2,000 people on our email list. And we have an in-person place that people gather. And so it's organic farming isn't just about farming. It's also a social movement that creates social space. And we don't have enough social spaces these days. So I think it's really important as a social space.
So I want to stick with the organic for a while.
Sure.
So the commercial large-scale agriculture involves a lot of petrochemicals, a lot of trucking long distances, shipping fruits and vegetables from Peru and Chile. It seems like it's very energy intensive, and yet when you go to the store, it seems like organic produce costs more, even though we think of it as a locally produced, smaller scale. So what's going on? How does it come to pass that these really extravagant, far-flung processes that seem so energy intensive end up being cheaper than something that's grown locally?
I want to say I think this question is more important than the many, many answers to it.
Okay.
Because it gives us a hack into the fact that our food puts us in touch with a range of issues that we overlook. So just the subsidization of fossil fuels is a big part of the answer to that.
Okay.
Obviously. And I love the name of your show because it points to the fact that things are changing and we need to adapt.
Right.
So that's part of the answer, but it's by far not the whole answer. I mean, another totally different answer is we make the people who are doing the good thing be the ones who get certified. You have to be certified as an organic farmer. You don't have to be certified as a conventional farmer.
Okay.
Wouldn't that make more sense?
Yeah. Like what pesticides are you using?
Yeah. And you have to pay for the social cost.
Yeah.
Of all the destruction that is being done. And I mean, pesticides are the easy thing to refer to. Uh-huh. Heavy tillage is actually the thing I'm really passionate about talking about.
Okay,
we'll need to learn the earth. Anyway.
Yeah, we'll need to learn more about that in a minute. Yeah, so if I go in Target, the oranges are all from California. It's hard to buy a Florida orange anymore. And that's partially because of the problems our groves are having, but it's also because somehow you can ship a orange from California and still make money. I don't know how that works.
Honestly, I have no idea how that works either. It makes, even with subsidization and all the things that we both know about, it still makes no sense. There must be also people who benefit from it in other ways.
Yeah. So are there have been, but I'm not aware, are there other organic operations, commercial organic operations in Sarasota right now?
There are, and I hope they're doing better than they were the last time I checked. It's a struggle.
Yeah.
There's a real struggle. There is Blumenberry Farm.
Okay.
But Mitch Blumenberry passed away, and so they've been they've been continuing.
Now, they started, as I recall, with blueberries. Is that right? Many years ago?
No.
No?
You must be thinking of the folks up in Manatee County.
No. This was a Sarasota blueberry operation.
Well, Mitch Blumenthal ran Global Organics.
Right.
And then he went and because he tried to get me to go run his farm. Uh-huh. So I saw it right when it started up.
Well, I visited one time and he was growing blueberries, and at that time it was pretty radical to grow blueberries this far south in Florida. And he was growing blueberries, and he was making money because he was shipping blueberries to France, and he could get the early market. He could get blueberries to France before anyone in Europe could produce blueberries. And so even though it was tremendously expensive to grow and sort and wash and ship blueberries to France, he could still make money at that point because it was the early crop and Parisians apparently would like some blueberries with their baguettes or whatever. But
let me just say one thing about that, because this gets at your question of other farms. Mm-hmm. The economics is what's tricky.
Yeah.
And Mitch obviously was very good with economics because he ran a distributor.
Right.
Bill Pisher, the founder of Jessica's, was a CPA before he was a farmer.
Wow.
And are you noticing a pattern?
Yeah.
Being good at economics is what keeps farmers in business. Yeah. And there's this really interesting word in German, and I forget the German word, but it's one of the words for farmer, and it's land economist.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's actually what you have to be to stay in business.
Well, I think here in this coast, the cost of land, I mean, it's how can you compete with the value for residential development? It's amazing anyone is doing any farming. We have last time I checked, we had under 100,000 acres of agriculture in Sarasota, but a lot of that agriculture was cow-calf operations, and some of it was citrus. And I don't know if they were counting sod or not, but they were probably counting sod. We don't eat a lot of bahia. And so the amount of actual row crops was probably pretty minimal, but I should really check with the... We have... People probably know this, but if you're doing agriculture in Sarasota County and probably in most counties in Florida, you can get an agricultural tax rate. And so that involves someone from the tax assessor's office essentially certifying what you're growing. And so they'll have a different value on 5-year-old grapefruit versus 15-year-old grapefruit. And so somewhere in Sarasota, there's a record of how many acres there are of various row crops, citrus, et cetera, that are getting this agricultural tax break.
The Rosemary District Association and WSLR present a Sarasota City Commission Candidate Forum happening at Fogartyville on Tuesday, October 15th from 5:30 to 8 p.m.
That sounds like today.
Yeah, it is today. Candidates for District 1 and District 2 will attend, including incumbents Kyle Batty and Liz Alpert, along with challengers Sequoia Felton and Ron Cashton. The event is open to the public and will begin with a meet and greet, followed by a forum moderated by Chair and Vice Chair of the Rosemary District Association, Anand Pelagar and Melissa Laughlin. The candidates will discuss important community issues. The evening will wrap up with a happy hour. Registration and more information for the October 15th Sarasota City Commission Candidate Forum is available at WSLR.org.
Go ahead, Julie.
Can we get back to regenerative agriculture?
Yes, yes. So
the candidate forum is being rescheduled.
Oh.
The candidate forum is being rescheduled.
Oh, okay. So the candidate forum will not happen today. It's being rescheduled.
That is late breaking news.
Somebody's on the ball.
Yeah.
That was Jesse.
Okay. Great. Thank you, Jesse. Well, so just to compare regenerative as a sort of organizing concept with organic, you know, I was talking about organics are both a strategy for farming and a sort of social movement. And I think you need to think very holistically if you're looking at any organizing principle for farming, because that's going to happen with anything. So regenerative is the same way. And the concept, you know, directly is that you leave the land in better shape than you found it, you know, and you partner with the land. And there's this almost spiritual idea of the land has its own agency and you're helping it regenerate, which I think is a very helpful and exciting idea. And I appreciate you bringing it up because there is a big movement among farmers to start to shift to using regenerative as the kind of guiding word. But then there's also the fact that that kind of spirituality, if you want to call it that, is resonant with a lot of social movements that are land-based now. And so there's a lot of indigenous leadership that wants to use regenerative to sort of harmonize with their own mythology about the world and get us to start relating to land rather than using it as a resource only.
So what are some of the approaches that or practices that regenerative agriculture promotes?
Yeah, so shifting from only having only meeting the organic bar. I mean, these are still going to be organic practices, but the two that are really big on my mind are shifting toward no-till strategies.
Explain what no-till is.
Sure. I mean, first of all, obviously it means you stop tilling mm-hmm. or you minimize it. You can use minimal tillage and still have no-till practices. Mm-hmm. I just want to say tillage is violent. So not only is it bad practice, but there is a sort of war against the earth that that gets practiced, and I think it's part of our fundamental ecological problem. The fungal networks and the roots partner in ways that there are studies to compare that to neural networks. It's sort of like there's a brain underground and we're pureeing it. Obviously, that's not a good thing to do. Mm-hmm.
So is tillage synonymous with plowing, or is it different?
It's more or less the same, yeah.
Okay. So it's so in conventional agriculture, at what point in the process does tillage take place?
Well, in organic farming, which I can speak to, it happens when the crop's done and right before you plant. So,
okay.
You know, you might till two or even more times.
Okay.
And
yeah.
And the goals of the tillage, like in the tillage mindset, if we were adopting tillage practices, what are we trying to accomplish with tillage?
Yeah, and I don't want to divorce myself from that. That's what I do professionally.
All right.
But it pains me greatly, and that's why I need to speak about it, because you're aerating the soil mechanically, which is very good for the roots in the short term.
Okay.
And you're putting fertilizer brought in usually from out of state and around the world into where the plants are going to need it.
Okay.
So it's a very efficient.
All right. So you add, I guess with organic, you would add a natural manure or something like chicken.
There are fertilizer mixes that are organic approved.
All right. So that gets tilled in into the soil. All right. Mm-hmm. And what effect does it have on weeds and weed seeds?
Well, I mean, obviously it gets rid of the weeds that are on the surface, but then it churns up the weed, seed bank.
Yeah, it wakes them up.
It wakes up all sorts of weeds. So there's a big problem with that.
Okay.
And then just to get back to no-till then, there are a whole bunch of more eloquent practices that have to do with partnering with the ground. One of the main ones that's very well known these days is you dip the roots of your starts are in some sort of fluid that gets them to partner with the fungi in the ground.
Wow.
And that makes them grow more efficiently. The fungi can bring nutrients from much farther away than the plant could reach, and they trade. It's a really beautiful way to do farming. The thing is, because of the explosive power of fossil fuels, it doesn't produce food quite as robustly as fossil fuel-based tillage agriculture. And so that's why it's slow to intrude into our processes.
So when you're planting a crop, you can dip the plant in and it's already a sprouted plant?
Yeah.
You can
start.
A start, and then you, and that encourages the fungal
partnership.
Partnership, and God, that's amazing. And so, if you're using no-till, you would just plant these plants with this fungal accelerator on their roots, and then you wouldn't do any tilling at all? You would just plant them at the appropriate spaces?
Yeah, and this is one of many examples of things you mix and match based on your soil and your conditions.
Mm-hmm.
So here in Florida, you can, and I've done this, you can mix up a compost just right so that you put the compost on the surface, water it in, it goes down into the sandy soil, so the nutrients do get down into the soil. And then what you've washed stays on the surface as a mulch.
Mm.
And you can have a compost that's both a fertilizer and a mulch all in one. Mm. But that's something you can only do here in a clay-heavy soil. You couldn't. So there's all these different mix-and-match strategies that make up what we collectively call no-till.
Well, I've heard people say in Florida, a lot of the agriculture is essentially hydroponics. You have quartz sand with no real nutritive value, and you're adding water and nutrients, and that's how a lot of citrus, for instance, is grown. You know, some of those citrus soils just look like Siesta Beach.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, when we drive through Homestead, there's they break up the limestone rock on the surface.
Growing plants in gravel.
And they plant, and then everything gets added in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we have a lot of different conditions here, and we're needing to do a lot of testing for these regenerative practices to figure out how to make them economically viable. Because in the big picture, maybe my gut feeling is that no-till will produce about two-thirds as much as tillage-based agriculture. So it won't produce as much, but then you're not paying for the fuel,
right.
You're not paying for the tractor maintenance,
right.
You're not paying the person to be on the tractor, which personnel is the number one cost.
Uh-huh.
So even though you're producing less, my gut feeling is that it will work out. But we need to work out these details because we don't want to put this on farmers to figure that out.
Right. So we periodically have guests from IFAS, the Institute for Food and Agricultural Science in Gainesville. Are they working on this no-till stuff or are they sticking more with the conventional agriculture?
As far as I can tell, it's just not in the culture of IFAS to touch this.
Yeah.
And, you know, you probably are in a better shape to make guesses as to why that is.
Yeah.
But I have checked with people locally, and they have basically said, hey, that's a great idea. You're right. That should happen. And I don't see that happening.
So we need to get a guest. Sarasota County is starting a program on some of the land that I believe they bought from the Albertans to help people get started in agriculture. Do you know much about that, Andrew?
I've toured it.
Okay. And if there's anything you'd like to say about that, that would be interesting.
I like the idea of you getting them on and asking them, you know, about that. But that's Rod Greeter, and he took over for who was our longtime guy?
I know.
He was a friend of the station.
Yeah.
Robert Clusen.
Rob Clusen,
So he took over Clusen's position, and he's one of the people who said, look, that sounds great, and I just don't see that happening.
Yeah. I tried to get the Turner family, the Hi-Hat Ranch folks, to take they're going to have a big development out there, and I tried to persuade them to leave the fields that are immediately adjacent to Fruitville Road and lease them out to people that wanted to get started in agriculture. And the premise would be that they would raise, you know, vegetables, and the people who lived in the community could come on a Thursday, let's say, and they would get first pick of the produce, and it was grown on their ranch, on their soil, and when their guests came down from wherever, they could brag that they were eating a meal grown on their in the development, and then on Friday and Saturday, it would be open to the public, and they'd have a farm stand there. But I think that's going to be housing instead. So there you go.
So talk about how permaculture combined with organic farming creates regenerative agriculture.
Or first talk about permaculture.
Sure, I'll say what permaculture is briefly. I mean, permaculture is a portmanteau, a putting together of two words, permanent and agriculture. And there are a lot of different definitions of it. The way I think of it is you're trying to create an ecosystem that is self-sustaining that also produces food for people. And ideally, the people then become part of that ecosystem. Permaculture is really, really important as a way of feeding information into agriculture. And that's another thing that should be researched on a regular basis systematically. Every ecosystem is tremendously different from the next one. And so we need people who create ecosystems, watch them produce food, and then advise agriculture on how to work with that particular place. That's the short answer.
Yeah. And did that, my recollection is that sort of came out of Australia originally?
Yeah.
Bill Mollison
and, but the other guy, they were gregarious people. So they were really good at getting to know people in their ecosystem. So my great uncle knew Bill Mollison. I'm trying to remember the other guy.
Okay.
The two founders of permaculture. They went and spent time in the Northwest, and my great uncle started a farm based on those conversations.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, it wasn't just those particular ecosystems in Australia. It was actually a movement to get people to know their ecosystems.
Right.
And an example of permaculture is fruit trees, right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's actually a really good hack into it, because I know the way I was describing it is very big picture. But yeah, we're very familiar with these things. So fruit trees, and I think an even deeper issue is weeds, where you can eat a lot of weeds. And there are a lot of weeds that actually are the descendants of crops that indigenous people grew. And then now we're getting really interesting.
Yeah. Well, Biden's, which is a little composite that grows everywhere, chickens love that. They'll eat that all day long. People can plant a mulberry tree in their chicken yard, and for several weeks or a month, the chickens get free food. They're not only getting the mulberries, but the fruit flies that are attracted to the mulberries, so they're getting a little protein mixed in there.
Awesome.
You are listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV 100.1 FM in Bradenton.
Okay, so we were, but Julia, you had asked about integrating permaculture with organic, is that right?
Right, and how that creates regenerative, how that those two combine for regenerative agriculture.
Yeah, and I appreciate you throwing out a couple examples, because it's hard to not take up the rest of the show answering this question. We are in the process at Jessica's of working on how those two go together. We have a food forest. It's going well. We have a row crop operation. It's stuck in the 80s.
Yeah.
Okay. It's this heavy tillage. It's this, you know, the fertilizer comes from Pennsylvania.
Plow and plant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we're working on it, but you don't mess with success.
I mean, no, you know, got to keep going.
To change the way Jessica's farms is to kill the golden goose. Yeah. So we're very slow to change that.
Yeah. So what you said you had 2,000 people that are
on your mailing list.
On our mailing list, yeah. We have 400 some a weekend.
Yeah.
Coming to that little plot.
So it's important to keep whatever you've been, whatever signal you've been sending. You need to keep sending that.
That's right.
But do you, now, is there any livestock involved at Jessica's?
No.
No. No. Are you aware of any places in this region that are integrating livestock with food production?
Well, of course, you guys know Pete Burkhart.
Yeah. Yes.
He had a really good integrated one-person show.
Right.
But the trick is, you know, integration involves so many dimensions.
Yeah.
You know, we've just been talking about permaculture, which is a whole learning curve we're on. And then there's animals, which we really need to be moving in that direction. And then there's also getting beyond individualism. We need, and that's, to me, why Jessica's is special, is it's not just a family farm. It's a small community of people. And that is very tricky to do in this culture. So it's a huge accomplishment. So anyway, I just want to throw out there, you know, when you talk about that dimension, I kind of think of a different dimension.
Yeah.
So do people come out to volunteer at the farm? Is that part of the community building?
Yeah, they some of them might be listening right now, because Tuesdays is when we have volunteers. And so to do that, people contact our webmaster who coordinates that. They don't contact me.
Okay.
Because it gets overwhelming.
Yeah.
But yeah, we have people come out and weed on Tuesdays. They work in the food forest, which a lot of people are very excited about learning about. And then we also actually are trying to get a bunch of people right now for hurricane pickup, because we're back operating, but there's a bunch of chaos that we've just had to kind of push to the side.
Well, so give that contact for people, for our listeners who might want to volunteer. Can you tell them how they would get in touch?
Sure. You can look up, in case you forget this, you can just look up Jessica's Organic Farm and, and write to the little contact box there. But the email is webmaster at jessicasorganicfarm.org.
Okay.
So,
.com. Jessicasorganicfarm.com.
All right.
So tell us what you have in your food forest.
Sure. The first thing you see is a bunch of bananas. And I'm speaking, I mean, I know something about it, but I'm not the person who runs mm-hmm. the food forest. I run the field operation.
The okay. tillage.
The tillage. Jab me with that over and over to remind me.
Okay. Andrew, there's a tillage guy.
I am a big fan. And one thing about permaculture is it's a matter of sequencing. So what's there now is not going to be what's there in 5 years. So you got to be thinking about how this ecosystem is going to evolve. So it's not the first thing you see, but there are a bunch of mango trees that are eventually going to be the canopy for that field that's right there on 47th as you drive by. You guys have been there, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you can picture, like, right by the stand where the food forest is. That's going to be a multi-story food forest with mangoes as the top story. And then bananas are naturally an understory thing. So the bananas will sort of migrate to the other side of that field under these mangoes that are growing, if you can picture that.
Mm-hmm.
And but then you also want areas of disturbance, which is a really important concept. You know, especially hurricanes, like our hurricanes are too big right now, but they are naturally occurring.
Yes.
Like these ecosystems are used to hurricanes.
Yeah.
And so you do want to create open spaces. And so the idea is we will grow a certain amount of row crops in the food forest systematically by moving those open spaces around and mimicking disturbance.
There was a guy in Sarasota, don't think he's with us any longer, but he had perfected growing papayas and sweet potatoes in the same operation, I think with a lot of mulch, and had really high yields for both.
Yeah, Johnny Papaya.
Yeah.
He was fantastic.
Yeah. So, you know, you have these people that acquire knowledge over decades, and then eventually they're not there anymore, and you wonder, well, how exactly did they do that? This is one of the things that's vexed the organic gardening at New College, is that you'll have students start to figure it out over a 3 or 4 year period, then they graduate. And unless everything's been written down in a place people can find in a manner they can understand, then the next year people show up and, you know, get a seed cat. They don't. What I've advocated is if you want a garden in Sarasota, go to an existing community garden and talk to people and find out what seeds they're using and how they're doing it, so that you're not just starting with Burpee's catalog and picking a plant that's never going to do well in Sarasota. And you should learn from people that already have some success rather than trying to recreate everything on your own.
Yeah, just real quickly, I think we need to build a culture of agriculture.
Uh-huh.
And
so the culture's right in the word. Is
yeah.
That, that's
yeah.
what you're saying.
Yeah. Oh, and you know, there are just so many, like, linguistic interconnections once you start, like, in my own little weird world. But I think 4-H is actually really important because of what you're talking about, because then you get kids coming up and building culture together. And so we have to start with cohorts. And this is, I want to give a big shout out to Dave Guatney at McIntosh Middle, who has started a 4-H club at McIntosh Middle School,
uh-huh.
which is like the most suburban place.
Uh-huh.
And he's being very successful. And he's got a whole farm there at McIntosh in the back.
Yeah.
So, big props to Dave, who I think is way ahead of us on the topic you're talking about.
Well, we should get Dave on the show.
So, let's talk about the concept of local food, and what does that mean, and how is it misrepresented in the big chain stores? Mm-hmm. Talk about all of that.
Sure. Well, this has been on my mind because I had an experience the other day where I was driving around Sarasota and I saw this new grocery store and it had two or three buzzwords on the front. And one of the words in foot and a half tall letters was local. And I thought, oh, fantastic. They must have local food.
Yeah.
And I thought that because I saw the word local on the front of the store.
Yeah.
You might see where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
So I went in, and in as friendly a way as I could, mm-hmm. I walked into the produce department of this upscale place, and I found somebody and asked about local food. And he looked like deer in the headlights. And he was so game. Like, he was a good, loyal soldier. And so he tried to walk me around to local food. But what he walked me, he just like walked around and he goes, well, I think maybe these are local. And he was pointing at white potatoes, which don't grow in Florida. So I knew from 10 feet away that those weren't local. So anyway, he tried. And I think that what we need is something that we had 10 years ago. And we can talk about why this doesn't exist. But we had a lot of consumers asking the people at their stores about local stuff, and we don't currently have that. And a big reason is we lost a huge advocate, which was Don Hall,
right?
Who founded Transition Sarasota, who was just passionate about that. Right. And not just passionate, but very, very skilled at equipping large numbers of people to ask those kinds of questions in a friendly way, because you're not going to get anywhere in Florida if you're not friendly and asking curious questions.
Well, so we still have remnants of that. We have the composting part of it sort of persisted, right?
Well, sure. Yeah. And don't get me wrong. Yeah. Like, we still have good people working on
right.
it. Like the Sunshine Community Compost is a really important local resource.
Right.
But they don't exactly work on training people to ask about local.
Yeah, right? I understand.
We do actually, I don't know if you know, but Eat Local Week still exists, and it's next week.
Okay.
So it is happening, and I'm supporting it by giving a tour at Jessica's, and so people can go to... They've changed the name of Transition to Community Harvest SRQ.
Yeah.
Right.
So go to Community Harvest SRQ. You can buy a $10 ticket, which will go, the money goes to Community Harvest. So we're supporting them. They do great work. And so I don't want to blame them.
Right.
Like, they didn't stop working on this. But there is, I really do feel like there is some cultural, not just cultural tide, economic tide. We have so many companies that benefit from claiming the word local.
Yeah.
But not investing deeply.
Now, I do remember when Whole Foods came to town, they contacted Buster Longino and said, can you provide local beef that's not sent out to feedlots in Texas and Oklahoma? And I think the response was something along the lines of, yes, but I'm not sure people would want to eat it. Like, because
what do you mean?
Well, because these are cows that are grazing, you know, out in the woods, basically. People are used to beef that's been fattened on corn in a feedlot.
Yeah.
And that has a different character than a piney woods cow that's been wandering around. And so he was just making a statement that people's taste is... that people become accustomed to eating corn-fed beef and not just a local cow that was butchered.
Well, I appreciate that story because that is a different take than what I usually hear.
Uh-huh.
And so he was thinking deeply about it, and kudos on him. Usually it's just all about economics, right? And I know for most of the farmers that I know, the economics of what Whole Foods was offering was not nearly enough to make a living.
Well, so something we haven't talked about is, you know, we used to have the celery fields, and there's still a place people can go eat called Packing House. Well, it doesn't matter how many fruits and vegetables you can produce, if you can't wash them and pack them and sell them, ship them and sell them, you got nothing. And so if the Packing House closes down, or to give a better example, citrus. There's not a lot of local citrus left in Sarasota. But I was told by one citrus grower that the most remunerative, the way they make the most money with citrus is with a local grove stand, with retirees and other people coming by fresh fruit and orange juice. But you can only sell so much that way if you have a good-sized grove. The rest has to go to a commercial citrus processor, and there aren't that many of them around. So if Tropicana or some other firm comes to you and offers you a price, if you don't accept it, you don't have anything to do with your crop. And so I don't know if you would call monopolies, but the way the distribution and processing system works, you're sort of a victim of the middlemen, the people that are going to buy your product and package it and put it in Target or Walmart or wherever. So that's that whole linkage where it really doesn't matter how successfully you can raise food if you can't market it and get it to the next stage, you got nothing.
Yeah. Can I reply to that after do your quarter hour thing?
You need to do...
Oh, you want to get... Okay. WSLR's fall membership drive, originally scheduled for October 9th through the 15th, that's now, has been postponed. The new dates will be October 13th through the 19th. This postponement allows the community to focus on recovery efforts and to prioritize their immediate needs. We appreciate your understanding and support, and we look forward to resuming the membership drive in November. Please stay tuned for more updates and stay safe.
And hooray, I want to give a plug for WSLR, and I'm afraid I'm going to forget. So I'll just say creating community is what farming depends on, and WSLR has been a really important partner for Jessica's and for a lot of farms. So I just want to encourage people to be members. This was originally going to be during the membership drive, so I was prepped to, like, give people an appeal. So everybody out there, just get ahead of the game and join now. I just wanted to sort of double down on what you were saying. The last statistics that I looked up, I kind of don't look at statistics about this anymore, but a few years ago, farmers got on average 6 cents on every food dollar. So if the end consumer buys an apple for a dollar, the farmer got 6 cents of that. And so direct sales is the way to stay in business, and you were talking about that. I want to pair that with our idea of building a culture of agriculture, because right now what you said is true. You can't make a living by just having a roadside stand. You can't sell most of your stuff. You got to go to some other strategy that gets you a lot less money. If we build a culture of agriculture, that can change slowly over time. And so if we get more of the food dollar directly to the farmer, then we can have more farmers, then we can have more local food. So I think the cultural strategy has to pair with the sort of economics.
So there's this concept called community-supported agriculture.
Yeah, whatever happened to CSAs?
And so we belonged for a while to a CSA, and it was a local farmer, and you would invest up front in a share of that crop, and then you would get... So
you would get a box of vegetables and have to figure out how to cook them. What they were all were and how to prepare them.
And that challenge was good,
yes,
right? That was a very
good,
generative, invigorating thing. And
so what's happened with CSAs?
I think a lot of us are wondering about that. I mean, I feel like I have a gut level sense of it, that there was an economic niche that Whole Foods and a lot of other companies realized they could move into more strongly. And they have benefited. And I don't mean to pick on Whole Foods. That's just a recognizable name. There's a bunch of companies that recognized that they could sort of blur that concept and get people to have the convenience of going there and getting whatever they want, which is very seductive. And I think in the big picture, that's the answer. Is there's been a cultural shift toward more green-ish groceries. Because there had been a proliferation of those during the same time that CSAs went away.
But I think my guess is that another challenge is when you get your box, you don't want the box to be a box all the same vegetable. It has to be, you would need to have a diverse offering of interesting different things that people would receive. And so that forces the farmer to not specialize in a few crops. They're going to have a pretty diverse range of things that comes along in different seasons. I mean, the complexity of it's pretty daunting, I would imagine.
That's true, and you need skilled farmers, and there are still lots of CSAs out there. So, you know, I said it went away. It only went away as a growing part of the economy. But So yes, that's true. We need skilled people, and it's a challenge, and we're working on that. The other part of it is people really need to change how they eat.
Okay.
And we need to be willing to eat things that grow naturally here.
Uh-huh.
You know, the grapes from Chile or wherever are just what everybody feels like.
Yeah.
And forget about hearts of cabbage palm or something.
Or muscadines.
Or muscadines,
yeah.
You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And those are the easy ones.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like we do, and I feel like to be on your show with integrity, I have to point out that we are way further in the ecological crisis than anybody is conscious of. Way farther ahead in that timeline.
Yeah.
You know, the future that most people are afraid of already started a while ago.
Yeah.
We're just insulated from it.
Yeah.
So we need to adapt to eating things that grow easily. And at Jessica's, we have tried over and over to shift what we're selling, and people don't buy it. So we need, you know, farmers need help.
Shift to stuff that is more easier to grow here?
Yeah, it's things that are more natural for Florida.
So give us some
okra
examples.
To start with.
Okay.
Like, even okra doesn't really sell.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not even natural here.
Right.
But it's a cultural thing.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, throughout the South, okra is really delectable, right?
right. And popular and culturally appropriate. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So even that one is tough to sell at Jessica's. And then you go to things like Malabar spinach or, you know, moringa. Moringa actually sells, but there's a weird reason for that. But there are a lot of things that that cater to the fact that our ecological overlap is with the Caribbean and South America rather than the northern U.S.
It's crazy. I mean, we're in this bizarre subtropical zone.
Yes.
And we could have a freeze, and we could also have really high temperatures. And so there's a lot of things that need a certain number of chilling hours. I mean, this whole thing about we didn't used to grow blueberries here, they had to work for quite a while to develop breeds that would set fruit here. And so I had tried for years to get a new college student to go work with the Vietnamese community in Sarasota. They would have people send plant material from the old country, either legally or not, because they missed certain foods that they'd grown in Vietnam, and figure out, well, what are they and what do they taste like and how do they grow? Like, when you're in the subtropics, it's not the same. This region, like Laurel, Florida, was one of the few places you could grow lychees commercially. And if you go further north in the state, it's too cold. If you go further south, it's too hot. There's sort of like a wavelength of things that could do well here. And despite all the plant explorers, David Fairchild and all these other folks, there are probably crops that would do well here with minimal care that we just haven't really connected with yet.
Well, and the people who live here don't culturally enjoy those
kinds
of foods.
Right, they don't know what they are.
Right,
yeah.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about Sabbath gardening.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Shall I just tell you about it?
Yeah.
So like you said in my intro, I'm a Mennonite pastor as well as a farmer, and I'm really interested in how there's a massive amount of agriculture, agrarian wisdom in the Bible. And I believe that that can inform us for our practices on the land here. This is not the first time there's been climate change. It's just the first time that it's been global.
Mm-hmm.
They had regional climate change throughout the ancient Near East, and they were dealing with that in surprisingly deeply similar ways to what we're dealing with. So they were trying to reconnect with land that had been abused. So are we. And so my idea is to take Sabbath gardening as this concept where Sabbath is a concept of not just people having rest, but the land having rest. So in the Sabbath code in the Bible, it says you're supposed to let the land rest for one out of every 7 years. So fallow practices are encoded in the Bible. Hmm. It's part of what Sabbath is about.
Okay.
Good agricultural practice. And that's actually very hard to get people to do. It's hard to get.
I wonder why. take a year off. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And there is a spiritual crisis mm-hmm. of coming to accept taking a year off. So that's where the spirituality of Sabbath farming is. Sabbath gardening is. It's not imposing some spirituality on what you're doing. It's like it's actually right there. You're already having these spiritual crises. And so it's setting up a garden and having a small community of people work with that space. And there are a million ways you can do this. But the basic idea is work with the space, learn from the land together. And if you start noticing yourself working too hard, stop. So it's you practice Sabbath in your body, because we have all of these ways that we are encoded to from our own life, from our heritage. You know, as settlers, places, like, we've got a lot encoded in our body in the form of trauma. And so Sabbath gardening is a way to do gardening, and then you have a group blessing you to take time off when you notice yourself getting too into it. And I've noticed that in myself and everybody I've ever supervised, that they actually will work themselves to death if you let them. They think they're lazy, and so they overcompensate. So it's a way of doing some inner healing and also learning to grow food, which we need to do in the urban spaces. You know, we need to not, like, I love how you're always challenging us to look at agricultural space within Sarasota County, but we need hyper-local growing in all of the neighborhoods.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so that's my model, is to invite especially churches, because to answer what you brought up earlier, where is the land? Well, church land is a big part of it.
Yeah.
And a lot of it's just lawn.
Smaller parking lots and bigger gardens.
Well, and smaller lawns.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah. We're already mowing lawns. What if we took those resources that go into mowing and upkeeping church lawns and make gardens?
Oof.
Yeah, so that's what I'm working on, and hopefully Sabbath Gardening will become its own nonprofit, and I'm going to be, you know, again, I just want to emphasize, this won't be me telling everybody how to do gardening. Everybody will be learning from their own land, and the land is actually part of the group, if that makes sense.
So we just have a few seconds left. Is there, give us the contact information again if people want to volunteer at Jessica's Organic Garden.
Well, first of all, sabbathgardening@gmail.com. If anybody's interested in that, love to talk to you. And then webmaster@jessicasorganicfarm.com if you want to come volunteer at Jessica's.
That's great. This has been a fantastic show and given us ideas for other shows.
You've been listening to Our Changing Environment on listener-sponsored WSLR LP Radio 96.5 FM, broadcasting from our downtown Sarasota studios on Kumquat Court.
Today's show, number 47, featured local Mennonite pastor and organic farmer Andrew Hudson.
Previous shows of Our Changing Environment may be accessed at the WSLR archives. Go to archive.wslr.org.
If you'd like to be notified about upcoming shows, you can join the Facebook group, Our Changing Environment.
And tune in at 9 a.m. 2 weeks from today on October 29th for the next broadcast of Our Changing Environment.
Next week, this time slot will feature Rebecca Acosta and the Healthy Living Hour.
If you're interested in local public affairs, tune in every Thursday at 9 a.m. for The Detail, hosted by Kathy Antunes.
And don't forget to check out the live music, public affairs, and other special events at Fogartyville on Lemon Lane, 6 blocks north of Main Street here in Sarasota.
Right now, stay tuned for Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! At 10 a.m.
And once again, the fall membership drive, originally scheduled for October 9th through the 15th, has been postponed. The new dates will be November 13th through the 19th. The, This postponement allows the community to focus on recovery efforts and prioritize their immediate needs. We appreciate your understanding and support, and we look forward to resuming the membership drive in November. Stay tuned for more updates, and please stay safe.
Our theme music is Vicky's Vamp, composed